T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts.
A Reardon roundtable coming up tomorrow. Jane will be here, State Rep Donna Behringer, and former Mizzou Tiger TJ Moe, who has become one of my Twitter favorites. He's going to weigh in. We got to break in a newbie on the roundtable, Sue. That is always fun.
Oh, yes.
Tomorrow, we have Peter Wood coming up from The Spectator this hour. Wrote a great piece about the culture war, saying there's nothing phony about the culture war. Remember, President Obama goes into Virginia saying that's nonsense. Well, it didn't turn out that way. And Peter will join us here in just a few minutes. John Lamping also weighing in. Look, Eric Gretton's got a big donation for his pack from the guy who founded Home Depot, like $1 million. So we'll handicap where we are with the Senate race in just a little bit as well. I didn't touch this one yesterday, but Fred and Dave, I'm assuming you probably heard, maybe not. Did you hear the story yesterday about Mark Meadows and the allegation that Trump had COVID before the debate?
Yeah. Yes. Fake news, right?
Well, Trump says fake news. It's in Mark Meadows' book. You know who else says it's fake news?
Mark Meadows.
Well, then why is it in there?
Okay.
Help me.
So, according to Meadows, Trump tested positive on September 26th. And then, I think this, is this September or is it October of last year? I got to check on it. Yeah, September 26th, okay? That was 3 days before the first presidential debate, 5 days before his diagnosis was confirmed. So, he tests positive on the 26th. There's a second test the same day that shows he's negative. So Mark Meadows is now spinning it, saying that the initial positive test was not accurate. The negative test was accurate. When it could have been, I mean, the other way around. In fact, I think you might have more information that it's the other way around simply because he tested positive after that. So in the book, he says, despite the president looking a little tired and suspecting a slight cold, Meadows says he was content that Trump traveled that evening to a rally in Middletown, Pennsylvania. On debate day, Meadows says Trump looked slightly better, emphasis on the word slightly. His face, for the most part at least, had regained its usual light bronze hue, and the gravel in his voice was gone, but the dark circles under his eyes had deepened. As we walked into the venue around 5 o'clock in the evening, I could tell that he was moving more slowly than usual. He walked like he was carrying a little extra weight on his back. So he clearly thinks that he had COVID before that. And then he's on Newsmax last night, and the guy says, the president says that that's fake news. And he says, yeah, well, the president's right. It's fake news. So you tell me, because the book says one thing, and now that he's pissed off Trump, he says something else. Trump was first tested with an unnamed old model kit. This is according to The Guardian, who is summarizing the book. They've had a chance to look at the book. And that gave a positive test result. With Trump already on board Air Force One, the White House appeared to rerun the same sample again with one of Abbott's Binax rapid antigen tests, which produced a negative result. Those tactics expressly conflict with recommendations from the CDC that a positive antigen test should be followed by a second, more accurate PCR test, which requires a fresh sample and is performed in a laboratory. So they didn't re-swab Trump for the second test to get a new sample. He was already on the airplane. They took the initial swab. The initial swab said, yes, positive test. Then they did it again, negative test, the test that they wanted, maybe. But it's interesting. And why it all matters at this point, I don't know, but it's going to be something that's going to get a lot of attention. It's going to help Mark Meadows sell books if he's saying something in the book that the president says is not true. And now he even admits, or at least he says is not true.
He admits it's not true, yet leaves it in the book.
He doesn't admit it's not true because what he says is there's just a misunderstanding about the test. But he, while in the book—
This hurts my head.
It's a timing question.
He doesn't say, in the book, Mark Meadows doesn't say that Trump had COVID before the first debate. What he says is there was a positive test, and he looked like crap all the way up until debate time. There was a negative test from the same sample as well. So he's saying, look, we tested it, and it was a negative test. But obviously, it doesn't look good, and the president reacts to that. So now they have some, CYA work to do. There was something else I was going to do here right before we got to Sue's News. But you know what? I completely forgot what it is, so maybe we should just do Sue's News because I have no recollection of
all
that.
Right, then.
These allegations are deeply concerning.
Does the president have any comment?
We're not going to comment.
It's not clear messaging.
No. And now, Sue's News. Brought to you by Sue.
Well, you know that HBO spent $30 million on that Game of Thrones prequel pilot, and it didn't get picked up as a series.
Oh!
They put all of that money into it, only to have, it was supposed to, remember this, it was supposed to star Naomi Watts.
Yeah, so this whole thing is dead now?
It's dead.
It's hard to believe with it being so popular.
Right? And the story is, can you believe they spent that much money on it? It was supposed to have star Naomi Watts. It was set thousands of years before the events of the Game of Thrones, but former Warner Media chairman Bob Greenblatt said in an interview he just didn't think it worked. It didn't deliver on the premise or the promise of the original series, and the HBO chief content officer didn't disagree. It's funny they didn't say that he agreed. It says he didn't disagree, and that was it for the series. So if you were looking forward to that, sorry. $30 million, too.
Seems like a lot of money, but if they're spending it is a lot of money, don't get me wrong, but yes. Thinking it through here, if they're spending $30 million on that, then that's going to be a $300 million season, right?
Right.
For the most part. So you got to cut your losses when you can. I'm guessing
that's exactly what he thought.
You know, that's pretty gutsy to sit back and say, I don't think it worked based on the popularity of the show.
Oh, I totally agree. So yeah. I don't know if it was just terrible or whether he didn't.
And we'll never get to see it probably, right?
Isn't that crazy?
I wonder if there's anything else where someone can buy that. I don't know how the legalities of that work. Or do they own that and then it's done? Yeah. Or can someone come in and say, okay, well, we want to develop that at Netflix or whatever?
Seriously good question. Fred, what were you going
to
say?
I just wanted to see how they could make Game of Thrones look thousands of years older
than
it already did.
That's probably what cost them $30 million, was trying to set it up so it looked as old. Yeah, I don't know. Alec Baldwin is doing an interview tonight with George Stephanopoulos on ABC, and we keep hearing little snippets from it, and we have some.
Well, if I can pop down the Sue's News.
Yeah, she was someone who was loved by everyone who worked with and liked by everyone who worked with and admired.
I think the big question, and the one you must have asked yourself 1,000 times, how could this have happened? It wasn't in the script for the trigger to be pulled.
Well, the trigger wasn't pulled. I didn't pull the trigger.
So you never pulled the trigger?
No. I would never point a gun at anyone and pull a trigger at them, never.
How did a real bullet get on that set?
I have no idea. Someone put a live bullet in a gun, a bullet that wasn't even supposed to be on the property.
You said you're not a victim, but is this the worst thing that's ever happened to you?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Because I think back, and I think of what could I have done.
Wow.
I don't even know what to make of that, because most people would agree that the guns don't fire themselves.
You know what? That's an interesting point. Okay, now, that's the big takeaway from this. He says he did not pull the trigger. The assistant director, Dave Halls, is supporting his claim. They both think it was a misfire. But then you talk to anybody who actually knows anything about guns. Seth Kenny was also interviewed. He's the owner of PDQ Arm and Prop LLC, which provided the guns and ammo to the production of Rust. And he says he's, quote, absolutely certain that PDQ Arm and Prop did not accidentally send live rounds to the movie set. So,
Then it gets to be conspiratorial if you start to think about how did that happen?
How did it happen?
And by the way, a misfire is not when the trigger fires itself.
Correct.
A misfire is when you pull the trigger and there's something wrong with the bullet casing or something gets jammed or something like that. You know, that's a misfire.
That's what experts go on to say. So, you know, it's great PR for this show tonight just to...
How long is it going to be? An hour thing with Stephanopoulos? Do we know?
I think so. And I had that looked up, Dave, and I lost it.
That seems like
in
a long time.
So, yeah, that's going to be very interesting tonight. But the fact that... That's what I was going to ask you... are more experienced, obviously, having any experience with guns. Can that happen at all? How could that happen?
Look, sometimes it does not take a tremendous amount of pressure to fire a gun, right? He definitely squeezed the trigger. He may not think that he squeezed the trigger. He squeezed the trigger.
Okay.
I'd have to be shown something dramatically different than what I know about guns to think that it just went off. Clearly, the gun went off and it was in his hand. I don't think he's denying that, right?
No.
I mean, think about the moment that it happened. It must have been so shocking. You probably wouldn't remember if you accidentally pulled the trigger or not.
True.
So maybe he accidentally pulled the trigger, but he pulled the trigger.
Yeah. And I'm sure he feels better thinking that he didn't and having this guy back. It's just, woof.
But I think I would focus more on the live round.
How did that get there?
That's the question. Now, remember, in the aftermath of this, one of the stories that came out, I think it was the second day, is that people in the movie industry came forward to say, look, sometimes this happens on movie sets. After the day is done, people take the weapons. They have live rounds. They go out and they plink. You know, they just shoot at targets and stuff like that.
That is not a good plan. Jack Dorsey's payment giant Square is changing its name to Block on December the 10th. Now, the change is supposed to reflect the company's growth into technologies like our favorite and nothing I understand, blockchain and crypto. A separate part of the company called Square Crypto will be dedicated to advancing Bitcoin. By the way, Square was founded in 2009, but what blockchain? Anyone? Fred?
Nope.
Fred?
Nope.
I like Square.
I like Square. That's a good name.
Square is great. It's still going to be traded as SQ on the Dow, so go figure.
I thought they're going to be Cube. I'm waiting for that. Cube.
Cube? It's probably already taken. You never know. Let's see. I'm going to do two more. All right. The secret's out. Nobody likes Secret Santa. Thank goodness we do not do that here. Do we? Oh, goodness. Now that I've said that.
If we do, I don't participate in it.
Yeah, I don't.
That's for sure.
A survey, of course, has found out that 79% of all Americans dread Secret Santa, actively hate it, in fact, say some. As a result, people say that they have... Thank you.
Thank the minions there.
Thank you, minions. They have received Secret Santa gifts. What are some of the worst of them? Well, here we go. Bars of soap. Knockoff Chia Pets. I didn't know there were knockoffs of Chia Pets.
This sounds like gifts you get like teachers around Christmas time.
It's bad enough to get a Chia Pet, and then you get a knockoff Chia Pet.
It's like a great value Chia Pet.
I did get a Chia Pet. The last time I was at one of these like White Elephant deals, which probably was 10 years ago, that's what I got as a Chia Pet.
Come on, they're kind of fun. And finally,
it was a person, and I can't remember who it was. It might have been
the big hair that comes out
the painter
Richard Bob Ross.
I don't know. All I know is I had a Chia Pet. Never grew it.
Well, that's sad. Bring it to me. I'll grow it. And finally, the most interesting thing given: random vegetables.
Well, that's just lazy. There's no thought put into that.
Look, I got a carrot. It's great news.
I feel bad telling somebody like, oh, thank you for the gift. By the way, do you got the receipt handy? I'm going to return this because it sucks so much.
For the vegetable?
You don't do that. You just re-gift.
And that's what they say. Yeah. People get around it by re-gifting. And finally, in Sue's news, a bride in North Carolina who had to delay her reception. They got married and then we're going to do a big reception. Well, she had to put it off twice during COVID. And almost had to again when her husband ate something weird and was hospitalized the night before. So she couldn't take it. She could not stand having to reschedule it again. So she strapped an iPad with a picture of his face on a clothing steamer, dressed it in a suit, and used it as a stand-in. It was a huge hit, and everybody loved it.
This is straight out of Modern Family.
It is, really isn't it?
I don't think I. Wait. What did she do? Like, he wasn't there. I missed something.
Yes.
He wasn't physically there.
He wasn't physically there. But why wasn't he physically there?
He was ill.
Okay.
He was in the hospital, and he did make it later
that
night.
She just didn't want to cancel it again. I got you.
She said, "I cannot possibly do it again." Right. The venue had let her put it off twice. And today's random fact: the most common species of armadillos. Well, of course, that's the nine-banded armadillo, Fred.
Uh-huh. Well, we all knew that.
Yeah.
Of course.
Always gives birth to identical quadruplets.
Quadruplets?
Ooh.
Identical?
Dump, dump, dump!
Well, yeah. I didn't have that. Oh, my God. That
Thank
is dramatic.
You.
That's a
Thank
great
you.
Random fact. 422, are the culture wars real? They are. Peter Wood from The Spectator knows that. Barack Obama does not. We'll get into it next.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back. Basketball is heating up. And the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
I think some of you might remember in the run-up to the Virginia governor's race, which saw Glenn Youngkin defeating Terry McAuliffe, the former president, Barack Obama, went into Virginia, and I highlighted this quite a bit in the week leading up to the election because I thought he was very, very wrong about that, about this, I should say, and it was sort of proven out.
Here we are trying to recover from a global pandemic that has killed more than 700,000 Americans, put millions in harm's way. We don't have time to waste on phony culture wars or fake outrage that the right-wing media are peddling just to juice up your ratings.
Well, that did not work out so well for Barack Obama, mainly because he was so wrong about this. And, you know, I mentioned at the beginning of the show, there's a column today by Jonathan Martin in the New York Times about this email that was sent out by a Democratic pollster who put up some big warnings for the left next year, which we know they won't take his advice, which is a good thing. You know, you got Cori Bush out there campaigning basically for Republicans. Peter Wood is at The Spectator. He wrote about this culture war issue, and I think you're right on. Peter, how are you? Welcome to 97.1 FM Talk.
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
What I said at the time when I heard Obama say that, because it's hard for me to believe that he's that dumb, that he thinks that the culture wars are phony. So either he was completely lying, which I'm going to have to go with that just because, gosh, he was president, and I thought he would know better, or are they that out of it and that disconnected at the Democrat Party to not realize what's really going on in this country?
Well, I don't overestimate Obama's intelligence. I think he's wrongly attributed a high degree of gray matter. But be that as it may, there's a strategy going on here. The left does not want people to think that the culture war is real. They want people to focus on their own interpretation of reality, which is something else entirely, a kind of a Christmas tree of gifts that will come showering down on the American public if only we agree to put ourselves many trillions of dollars further in debt. So getting out of the sights of the culture war is important for the left's political strategy, and it likes to pretend that this all this grumbling about culture is just a diversionary tactic by right-wing fanatics who will do whatever they can to undermine the great goodness of President Biden and Vice President Harris. So one recognizes the tactic, but I don't think it necessarily means the tactic is very smart. The result in Virginia, I think, was just to further inflame the public, which was looking about at what was going on in the schools as a symptom of the efforts of the authoritarian left to impose its doctrines on all of us, schools being a central avenue of that imposition, but not all of it.
Yeah. Peter, you described the culture wars at this moment in our history as standoffs between an entrenched leftist establishment that has nothing to gain from real debate and an upstart movement of skeptics, usually parents now, which is interesting, who have nothing to lose by challenging the left's premises. So how do you think, because I see things in the last year and a half just in my region here with parents really getting involved, not only on CRT, certainly on CRT, but in the masking wars, on youth sports, which were restricted, all of these things, people who ordinarily would not be active. And now they're paying attention a little bit more because they got to see, I mean, if there's any positive from the pandemic, they got a little glimpse into what was happening in these schools. And the mama bears in particular are kind of pissed off, aren't they?
They are. You know, I've been essentially in the culture wars for more than 30 years, and I had an organization, the National Association of Scholars, that during much of that time has been fighting to convince Americans that what was going on in their schools and their colleges and universities was an effort to transform American society. Never until the last year has that message really leaped across to large numbers of Americans. Now millions of people are tuning into it. I think part of it had to do with the seeing their children have their school lessons zoomed into their bedrooms and have a chance to see what was going on there. But there was more stuff going on as well. The gulf between what we saw with the burning of our cities in 2020 and the results of seeing the riot in the Capitol Hill treated as an insurrection, but all that other stuff just swept under the rug. People began to notice that there is this huge discrepancy between what the media tells us and what our five senses show us. And when that caught up with what was going on with the school curricula, it kind of clicked into place for a lot of people who previously had been just sort of keeping this on the edge of their awareness or not being aware of it at all. So the Virginia race is a benchmark, I think, of a transformation that is now happening among, what shall I say, us deplorables. We're beginning to see some light.
Let me explore this a little bit, because I think it's beyond the deplorables at this point, and this is where it really poses issues, thankfully, for the Democrats. And I mentioned that memo that was written by Brian Stryker, who's a pollster, sent out. I read some of that memo earlier this afternoon because Jonathan Martin wrote about it. But he was advising Democrats, basically, look, you got a problem. You got a branding problem that is deeper than a lot of people suspect. And I want to talk about it in terms of the culture wars in this sense. Now, I'm not going to say this is something that is predominant, maybe even in Virginia, although I think that the autopsy after Virginia has discovered this. But there are a lot of moderate Democrats, people who maybe they didn't vote for Trump either time, but they might vote for a Republican, right? That they don't like this stuff at all. They don't like cancel culture. They don't like CRT. They don't like all this attention on gender. And I'm talking about people who vote Democrat sometimes, or at least half the time.
Yeah.
And they're, so that's where it's broadened now, because, and these are people, I would say that a lot of those people are ones, they're not going to be vocal about what they feel, right? Because they don't want to be canceled themselves. It goes back to what I remember Joe Scarborough was saying on MSNBC over the summer when some of the CRT was heating up. And he admitted that he was concerned about it. And he's got some of his big liberal friends that have all these kids in private schools in New York that don't want to say anything publicly. But they go to Scarborough and say, good Lord, what the hell is going on? So they're afraid to say things, but they're also on the right side of the culture wars, I think, at this point.
Yes, I think that's accurate. I mean, there is a core of people who are already activized, but we are now seeing the suburban moms and pops who are generally liberal in their sentiments, but are finding the radicalization of the Democratic Party, the adoption of the squad as the new normal, with AOC sort of leading the way. That's become something that frightens them down to their very socks. They're looking at this as a a transformation of the party they supported into a party they can no longer support. Yes, the strategists for the Democratic Party are thinking, whoa, we've got to find some way to corral these people back into our reservation. The way to do that is, of course, to make the criticism of CRT an embarrassment. So the culture wars always has this soft edge to it of people who can be brought into it on one side or the other, depending on how it gets flavored. And well, right now, the conservatives are winning.
The concern that I would have, though, moving forward, and we see this, you know, even after Virginia, is there's such dishonesty in the mainstream media about some of these issues. And, you know, even when they feel forced, I suppose, to acknowledge critical race theory and how it's become a problem for the Democrats, they always have to have the caveat, which is not true and fake news, that, you know, critical race theory is not really being implemented in schools in Virginia or wherever else. When we have every day, Peter, I'm sure you're dialed into this, more and more evidence that, yeah, in fact, it is being implicated and these kids are being indoctrinated with CRT on a regular basis. I mean, some of us have known that for a while. Now it's finally being exposed.
Right. Well, the left wants to pretend it's not CRT by giving a definition to CRT that is so esoteric.
Yes.
It doesn't make any sense at all. But CRT is a perfectly good label for that bundle of things that includes the 1619 Project, the diversity, equity, inclusion agenda, what's sometimes called the new abolitionism, the anti-racism stuff. If you need one word to capture it all, I think CRT gets at it. The basic idea being that we are a systemically racist society and every institution is infused with racism. Now, they want to say that, but they don't want to say that it's called CRT because Chris Rufo and others have succeeded in making that term radioactive.
Well, and Chris has been leading the way. In fact, I think I retweeted something else that he had this afternoon. One thing that was interesting, and I'd have to go back and look at the entire memo from Mr. Stryker, but when Jonathan Martin wrote about all of this in the New York Times today, there was I read it twice just because I was fascinated that there was no mention, not one mention in that piece of critical race theory. Now, it's come up. Believe me, that pollster is aware because he wrote about it in the memo. He refers to CRT many times. Why would the New York Times not acknowledge that that was a big part of that race in Virginia? That's a big section of that narrative that's just been completely zapped by that column by Jonathan Martin, which is a little confusing to me.
Well, I mean, I don't have an answer to that other than the obvious one that they're afraid of it.
Yeah, I think that's it.
CRT has been in circulation from back in the 1980s when Derrick Bell at Harvard was promoting the idea. I was writing about it back then, and people who have been paying attention to racial politics in this country know that this has been a kind of master concept for the left now for more than a generation. Now that it's broken out into the open, the Times is terrified.
Yeah.
Who has done more to promote, in effect, CRT than the Times itself? That's what the 1619 Project is all about.
Yep, that's exactly right.
But they dare not speak its name.
No, exactly. Well, Peter, thank you so much for coming on here this afternoon at The Spectator. Great column about the culture war. You're absolutely right. These things are real. They will continue into next year and beyond. Peter Wood, appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Looks like the House has just approved a bill. We had Congressman Jason Smith on earlier. He was going off to a vote. Remember, as we wrapped up the interview, the House has passed an extension of government funding through February 18th. He had talked about that during the interview. So that is a done deal. The vote 221 to 212. We'll keep you posted on that. And we'll talk about it during the roundtable tomorrow. So this was a pretty significant story today. Former State Senator John Lamping is with me this afternoon to analyze just a little bit. Home Depot founder Bernie Marcus has put $1 million behind former Governor Eric Greitens in his Senate bid next year. He actually gave it to a PAC, Missouri First Action. John, how are you this afternoon, first and foremost?
Mark, I'm doing great. Beautiful, beautiful winter afternoon. Huh?
Oh, my God. It was awesome today. So this seems relatively significant, right? Not insignificant, significant.
It's significant for more than just a dollar figure. So what your listeners should know is that Bernie Marcus, founder of Home Depot, has been a long time huge contributor to Republican Party, primarily in the Senate. He, for forever and ever, he was an establishment-type donor. He initially supported Jeb Bush in 2016, eventually supported Trump, and then supported Trump again in 20. But was a significant moment in his political giving occurred in 2018. And what had happened, just to remind your listeners, in 2017, in the first 2 years of Trump's terms in office, we had, you know, we had Paul Ryan and we had Mitch McConnell in charge of the Congress, and they could not balance a budget. They dramatically increased government spending, and donors like Bernie Marcus had had enough with that approach to governing. Right. So what then happened is Steve Bannon, who you may know is as an advisor to President Trump, but really he is the head of a very powerful and growing populist movement within the Republican Party that's kind of anti-large corporation, is, you know, pro-America First and all that stuff. Well, Bannon began a process of working with people like Bernie Marcus to get him to contribute to a different approach to funding races for the U.S. Senate race. And so with today's donation is a signal to all the donors that, feel the same way, that Eric Grimes is their choice in this race. And this is the second billionaire that's contributed the second $1 million to this race. But it is a very strong signal that Grimes will have $8 or $10 million minimum to compete in the primary.
Yeah. So where, you know, I haven't looked at the figures this week, but obviously we know that the Attorney General Eric Schmidt has raised a lot of money. I don't know how this compares to what some of these other candidates like Billy Long and Vicky have, John, when it comes to their war chest. Do you know?
Yeah, so Billy and Vicky are in the, you know, $1 million to $2 million. Eric Schmidt is the most, he's raising the most money overall with the most donors. But Eric is running a very traditional campaign. He's spending hundreds of thousands of dollars a month. So, you know, he'll raise $1 million and spend $600,000 or $700,000. That's not a bad thing. He's running a much more traditional campaign. But Greitens, who is not running, he's running a completely anti-traditional campaign. He's going to come in with the full weight of the Steve Bannon movement behind him, and that with money is going to, it's going to be really hard for him not to be in the 20s to mid to high 20s and 30s. And we can look at dollars raised, we can look at poll numbers, but the most important number, I think, is the number of people that keep getting into this race. And you saw Dave Schatz got in a week or two ago.
Right.
And you had Jason Smith on earlier, and there's a lot of talk about Jason getting in. And as long as if we stay with five or six candidates in this race, it's going to be mid-20s, high-20s will be the winner. And I think the path for Greitens to do that is there. Now, of course, everyone is waiting for Trump to weigh in.
Right.
Well, I'll tell you what, he respects donors like this, and that donor will have as much sway potentially with Trump as anybody else will have.
So Billy comes back. Congressman Long's at Mar-a-Lago last week before Thanksgiving. He comes back. He says, he's not going to say who it is. He says, Trump said he's not going to endorse two candidates in this race.
Right.
Want to take a guess at those? Who would those
McCloskey?
Be?
McCloskey.
Okay, I would assume McCloskey because he's not a serious candidate. I wish he'd go away. Who's the other?
Right. Well, then, who knows? Maybe it's Billy. I mean, Billy's implying that it's Eric, right? And Billy has said that even if I'm not the one that gets endorsed, I'm not getting out of the race. You know, I think the what's really a difficult thing for all of these candidates, and I think in particular Eric Schmidt, is like whoever is aligning with McConnell, that person's not getting endorsed by Trump. Okay? So Grimes, again, is the only one that's come out and says, look, when elected, I am not voting for McConnell. Well, that's huge. That's what Trump wants to hear. None of the other candidates are willing to say that. And so, you know, it remains to be seen where this goes. But if any of these people get the stamp of McConnell on them, then they're not going to get endorsed by Trump.
Yeah, it's interesting, too. Did you see this? This was certainly undercovered. But did you see what Greitens did on the Second Amendment Preservation Act?
He did.
Yeah, he sort of flipped it around, basically. Well, there was a 60 Minutes story from a few weeks ago, and you have Republicans that are obviously, some are defending the law, Governor Parsons defending the law. Greitens comes in and says, look, they basically defunded the police.
Well, that's very typical. Eric loves to poke at the establishment, and Missouri Republican establishment, that's who passed this law. And I personally might agree with the law, but they did a pretty horrible job in communicating this law. It's not clear to all people involved. So look, it's no secret that Governor Parsons, who was lieutenant governor at the time, and the Republican Party establishment coalesced around this opportunity to push Eric Greitens out of the governor's office. That's no secret to anyone. And I didn't expect Eric to do that, Eric Greitens to do that, but I'm not surprised in the least bit that he did what he did. And quite frankly, I think it'll be effective, because I think that we all look at that law and go, oh, yeah, that makes sense. You know, the federal government tell us what to do. But, man, it's poorly executed so far.
So one of the things that is said behind the scenes, and I've said it before, and you can tell me if how much truth you think there is to this, is that if you look at the dynamics of all the players, and when I say all the players, Trump's included here. Josh Hawley, I think, is included. So if the other United States senator from Missouri, Senator Hawley, is not too fond of Eric Greitens, which we don't think that they're on each other's Christmas cards list, isn't he going to have some influence here?
Well, if Josh Hawley is willing to endorse one of the other candidates in the primary, well, then, yeah, he's got an opportunity to have influence. But my guess is Josh Hawley's not going to put his finger on the scale. He's not going to support any of the other candidates. Look, everyone's afraid to make a mistake. They're afraid to take on the establishment, right? So the reason, I've had meetings with some of these candidates. I said, look, if the public is – Missouri Republican Party primary voters don't like McConnell. You need to come out and say you're not supporting McConnell. And they can tell you privately they won't support McConnell, or they think he's – they get the sentiment, but they won't say it. And the reason they won't say it out loud is because when the dust settles and if they win, they want McConnell to fund them. Right. So as long as no one else is not willing to come out against the Republican Party establishment, people don't understand that the Missouri Republican Party primary voters, they hate the establishment Republicans as much as they hate the Democratic Party. So you need to campaign against that.
Well, I think you're right about that. Yeah, and it's important to recognize that primary is very different than what will happen in the general. Former Senator John Lapping, great to have you on, John. I appreciate it. Out of time.
Talk to you soon.
4:55. Michael Goodwin from the New York Post. Always great to catch up with him. He wrote a great column on Joe Biden and Build Back Better. Tim Sommer, also former music journalist for Record Executive. We're going to talk a little bit about the Beatles documentary and also some, I think, very unique music financing models that Tidal is rolling out. All of that and more, plus an audio cut of the day coming up.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL Draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.